Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 39.
After some computer troubles last week, I am back with Sachi Takao-san, who gives us her review of the book Nihonjin ga Sekai ni Hokoreru 33 no Koto. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And no, I haven't left the country, and no, I haven't shut the show down. There was no show last week, and some people had emailed me asking me if I'd left Japan or if I'd shut the show down. But no, that's neither one of those are true. What happened was my MacBook Pro that I used to edit this show actually broke. What happened was the temperature sensor on the CPU suddenly decided to stop working. So any little activity that I used the computer for would cause the CPU to overheat and the thing would get really hot and basically shut itself down. So I had to take it into the technical support people at the Apple store in Ginza. And it was kind of actually an interesting procedure because I've never had to take my computer in for repair before. I've owned Macs since 1996, and I've owned dozens of them since then. My first computer, actually, it was a Performa 6200. I believe it had a 75 megahertz processor. It had 8 megabytes of RAM, not gigabytes, megabytes of RAM. And then it had a 14.4 modem. This is not even broadband, it's just a modem that I remember when I upgraded it to a 33.6 modem, I thought I was just smoking along the information superhighway. But anyways, I've had dozens of Macs since then. I've never ever had a problem. This is my first time. So it was kind of a neat experience for me to go to the Apple store. And what was cool is you can download an app for your iPhone that allows you to book the appointment with the tech support at Apple. And then when you get to the Apple store, the app automatically recognizes that you're there, checks you in, alerts the staff that you're there, and gives you an indicator of how many people are in front of you in the line. And when it's your turn, the app actually sends you a message saying, hey, we're ready, come on up to the support desk and we'll take care of you. So I thought that was all a pretty cool, slick way of dealing with tech support. What wasn't so cool was the fact that the sensor on my logic board was dead, and $500 I have to spend to repair this stupid sensor. And what's even more annoying is that I am going to replace this computer the nanosecond Apple releases new iMacs. I was actually hoping that Apple was going to release a new iMac back at the Worldwide Developer Conference a few weeks ago, but they didn't. So I am waiting here, credit card in hand, for the split second that Apple introduces a new iMac, I'm going to go buy a couple of them. And so to have to spend money on my MacBook Pro, which I'm going to get rid of as soon as I get the new one, was a little bit frustrating. But anyways, I still don't have my computer back. I'm using a backup MacBook Pro, an older one that I've had for a while. And so this particular show is going to be a rather short show. And I'm hoping that I am back up to speed by next week. So on today's show, what I wanted to do is I wanted to give a review of my friend Ruth Jarman's new book. The Japanese title is Nihonjin ga Sekai ni Hokoreru 33 no Koto. The English translation of that is 33 More Reasons to be Proud. If you remember from Tokyo Podcast episode number 34, Ruth-san has been in Japan for a long time, and she wrote this book to document kind of all the great things that she sees about Japan. And unfortunately, Ruth's book is all in Japanese, and she doesn't have any immediate plans to translate it to English yet. So my Nihongo is not good enough to read this book and give a proper review. So I asked my good friend Sachiko Takao-san to read the book and join us and give us her review. If you remember from episode number 20, Sachi was the lady who rode her bicycle from Okinawa to Hokkaido and documented her trip on her website, findingsachi.com. So I've asked Sachi to join me today and give us her review of Ruth's book.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you for having me back.
But maybe you could give the audience a quick update on what you've been up to since last time we talked.
Since the last time, I've been going back and forth quite a bit between Taiwan and Japan for some business, which has been a really interesting learning experience for me because I've always worked in America and then also in the UK, and now kind of dealing more with the Asia side of business. And it's really different to see the different cultures and also the food, and it's been really fun.
I guess for you, you went to an American university and worked mostly in foreign companies, right? So
yes.
You've never actually worked for a Japanese company.
Yeah, not as a full-time employee, no.
Right, okay. Have you been doing any cycling?
Not much. Well, you've seen the rain lately, right?
Right.
And yeah, I've been doing a little bit of cycling, but at the same time, not as much as last year. Yeah, I should be doing more.
Okay, so you're kind of interesting in that you have a similarity to Ruth-san in that Ruth graduated university and came to Japan here and worked continuously for Japanese companies. And you've gone the opposite way. You graduated from American company or university and worked for American companies. So you guys have kind of a similar path, but going the opposite way.
Yes.
You've read her book. And so I thought it'd be kind of interesting to hear your perspective on what you think of as a Japanese person. What do you think of her book? So can you kind of start us off by giving us a quick summary of what the book is about?
The summary is that, so she's been living and working in Japan for many years now, and she wrote about 33 more things that Japanese people can be proud of that we may not notice by just living here and then not being able to compare between the other cultures and Japan. So she addressed lots of the things that we should be more proud of, instead of instead of the opposite. So, and clearly you can see how much she loves Japan by reading this. And some things I thought that as negative before can be taken as a positive from her way of viewing. So I thought that was really good to read this. And I highly recommend that Japanese people read this and they rediscover Japan and its culture from a foreigner's eye.
Yeah, that's interesting. Ruth-san is definitely a fan of Japan. She's been here a long time, has a real good understanding of Japanese culture, and she is, I'm sure she'd agree with me, that she is super excited about being here in Japan.
Yes. She's an energetic person, isn't she?
Oh, she's Genki. She is Genki personified. If you look up Genki in a dictionary, they should just put a picture of her there.
Yes,
no explanation needed.
Ruth.
But I wanted to clarify that this book is not 33 things that Japanese people are better at than the rest of the world, right? It's not like that Japanese people are better than the rest of the world in these 33 things. That's not the message, correct?
No, that's not the thing. And in fact, if some other people look at some of these things, they might look at it in a negative way. But Ruth has a way of looking at it, and then from her understanding of the culture, really good understanding of the culture, she sees the good things in those 33 items.
So can you give us a few examples then? I'm particularly interested in examples that where you said, you know, like as a Japanese person, is something you may not have noticed.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. The good thing, the things that came up a lot throughout the book was about teamwork and the sense of team and versus the individuality, which is really different between the Western world and in Japan. So she talks a lot about the teamwork in the business environment. And then also in the situations like the last year's tsunami and then the recovery after.
When you were working in a Japanese or American company, what did you find about the teamwork? Did you find it was individualistic?
More individualistic than teamwork.
Right.
So one of the examples in this book is that when you're hired, the companies in the West seek for immediate action or immediate usefulness of the skill of the worker.
Right.
Which is, of course, there's that in Japan too, but that's more of a recent movement, I think. And so when you're hired in the Japanese companies, according to Ruth, there is a more of a period of education, and they see you, the worker, as a long-term investment to the company.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Which is really nice, I think, in building up the loyalty. She says this too. The loyalty management in the Japanese companies is something that Japanese people should be proud of. Instead of expendable workers, having expendable employees in the companies. They don't say that in the company environment, but you know, in some company situations, particularly in the West, I think there is the sense of workers being expendable.
Right. And I know in the West, retention is a big issue for many companies, you know,
yeah.
Especially in the tech industry,
oh, yeah.
Where executives are being headhunted all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I don't think either side is right or wrong. I think that just illustrates the difference in business culture between, say, America and Japan. Because
exactly.
In America, the company understands that employees are not going to stay with the company forever. You know, it's not uncommon for American workers to move on to better opportunities.
Exactly.
So I think that could be why American companies look for immediate output, because they know that person's not going to stick around for forever.
Right. Yeah, this comes from the difference in the employment situation in Japan. Now it's not like this, but before, when you were hired, you were to stay in that company for life until
right.
your retirement. And it's not like that anymore. So people are moving around a lot more. So it's changing in that way and being more westernized. But then again, I think there are still a lot of loyalty to the company that you work for.
Right.
I do have a sour experience of working for an American corporation before. I had the total Japanese mentality of giving the entire 120% to the company and devoting myself as a worker with the loyalty. And I heard my management saying, you know, something to the opposite effect of that, or that person not seeing the company as like I was seeing.
Right.
So I got disappointed hugely, and I was younger too, and I thought that, wow, you know, what have I been doing? What should I do? I want to work hard and do the best that I can for this team, for the company, because they pay me and then they do me well and then they treated me very well too. But at the same time, that kind of mentality from around me, you know, started to make me realize the reality.
So Ruth-san is saying that the loyalty mentality is quite strong amongst your fellow workers?
In Japan, yes.
In Japan.
She says absolutely
right.
Yes. And then that could actually benefit the company too in America or the Western world, she's saying.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, building up the loyalty lets the workers stay long and then also devote themselves more to the company, which makes the company more profitable or prosper.
Right.
So, yeah, in all, that works better. And then, of course, there's a more of an emotional fulfillment while working in the company.
I think also, too, is that I think, you know, that kind of indicates to me that Japanese companies take a long-term view of their staff and their company.
So, okay. It may take a long time to create the perfect team, but when it is created, the bond is stronger. Working as a team is much better than working as an individual. It gathers more brains into the team, so that makes things better. Have you heard of the word Kaizen?
Yeah, Kaizen, what does that mean? To make things better? Yes. To improve?
To improve. Right. But this, did you learn that in Japan, that word?
No, I think I learned it somewhere in America or back home in Canada.
I didn't know this until I was working in a tech company, and then one engineer told me, I know the word Kaizen. It's like, Kaizen? You mean the Japanese word Kaizen? He's like, yes, in the programmer world, and then also in the car industry outside of Japan, they use the word Kaizen to make things better, to improve.
Right.
I thought that was really interesting in that, of course, every company wants to improve things, but the fact that that word came from Japan and then being used all over the world, I found it interesting.
Did she talk about Kaizen in her book?
No. The reason why I thought about that was because she was talking about the modesty and the humility of Japanese people, which leads to improvement of things. For example, she talks about the entitlement of the people in the West, of how if you are getting paid, you're entitled to do something in a certain way at work, such as a receptionist or somebody who's working at a till, having legs up and then kind of making you wait. You're the customer, and then you're trying to pay or trying to ask somebody something, and then that person is on the phone, and then they make you wait. And you don't see that at all in Japan, right?
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, but she pointed that out, and there's a sense of entitlement, whereas if you go to a convenience store in Japan and you go, and then the customer is king, there's a certain modesty and humility in treating other people.
Right. Yeah.
Which leads to improvement of different acts. And then I've heard of that Kaizen word. It's other than Japan. that led me to that thought.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that sense of entitlement, I think, is a big issue and a controversial issue, I think, in America right now, with all ages and all aspects of American culture. I think, you know, not only, as Ruth pointed out in the book, like in a working environment where, you know, CEOs or executives feel they're entitled to a certain status level.
Yes.
But I think there's a big kind of debate in the States right now about this younger generation who feel the sense of entitlement.
Right. But not doing much.
But not doing anything to earn it, you know? So.
Exactly. So if you don't have it, why not work for it and then get it? And instead of asking for the entitlement without doing anything first.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Are most of the analogies in the book based on business?
A lot, yes, most of it is from business, which is really interesting now that I read it. So maybe for people who are working right now in Japan, I think this would be good to read. Because you see, in Japan, globalization is happening, but it's probably come a bit slower than other countries. And there was a confusion in how to treat the foreigners. It's in the book too. And how Ruth was kind of seen differently or treated a little bit hesitantly when she came back, you know, 20-something years ago.
Right.
But now there's a section of the book where she talks about the smiles of Japanese people, that it's gotten a lot better than before. Like, people smile a lot more to her. Which is really interesting, because I don't know how it was back then when she came first here. But
people didn't smile. Maybe they were...
They were more scared.
Scared, maybe?
Yes, of Western-looking people.
Right.
If she looked at somebody, and then they would think, oh no, I have to speak English. That was the first reaction. So they look away or they say, this is a pen or something. This is an example of what she raises in the book. It's really interesting because that's one of the first sentences that we learn in English classes.
Right.
So, people would say, this is a pen, I'll run away. And Ruth used to think, what a strange man. But that was a scared reaction of, you know, not being able to speak or not willing to speak English. But she says it is changing. And I feel that too. I think people are more willing to be in that kind of situation, to face foreigners and welcome people.
I think globalization has really caught Japan off guard. I think it has moved throughout the rest of the world much quicker than Japan ever anticipated. However, Japan's progress compared to other countries such as China or Singapore or Korea is obviously a lot slower. However, I think if you compare it to 20 years ago, or even maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I think it's a lot better.
Yes.
Like Ruth-san said in her book, you know, nowadays Japanese people are willing to engage in conversation with foreigners even if their English is not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas 20 years ago, they would just say, this is a pen, and run away.
Yeah, exactly. I think people are afraid of making mistakes here.
Right.
And because they tend to be more perfectionist. It's part of the culture. You know, there are lots of otakus in Japan.
Right.
In different fields. That's coming from their mentality of wanting to be perfect. And then wanting to be perfect doesn't necessarily work when you want to speak a foreign language. Because
right.
The key is not to speak perfectly or having the perfect vocabulary or grammar. It's more about being able to address your feelings. And no one cares if it's correct or not, the grammar, that is.
Right, right.
Recently, too, I've been doing international business and having lots of Japanese people in certain meetings too. And many of them don't speak English at all, or they say they don't speak English at all, like zero. But in the meeting, you know, they say words or some things in English, and then the foreign people would say, they can speak English, what are they talking about? So I think Japanese people need not to worry about being perfect in speaking English, but more enjoy the content of it more.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Japanese people need to learn how to communicate.
Yes.
More so, and not worry so much about the language. You know, there's that old saying that, you know, 90% of our communication is non-vocal, right? Only about, 10% of what you communicate with is your words. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is body language and
exactly.
Everything else. So I think like one of the struggles that Japanese people have is being able just to communicate with the English that they have.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's perfect or not, it doesn't matter. But can you communicate with the knowledge of the language that you have?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've seen foreigners here in the same position. I mean, they're so worried about speaking Japanese, they don't try it at all. So it kind of is both ways. But I think that we foreigners, we're not so worried about making mistakes as much as Japanese people are. I mean, we can butcher the Japanese language and we don't care. If the person understands, we're happy.
Exactly. Yeah, that kind of mentality is still something that we need to work on, I
right.
think. Yeah.
Right,
right now, I just remembered somebody that I work with. He's a Taiwanese person and he's older. He doesn't speak much English or Japanese, and we try to communicate in English. And it takes forever for him to come up with the word or the correct word, but he still really wants to say something to me. So there's a big gap and silence. But there's something that we enjoy in the silence, or writing in kanji or something,
right.
You know, on paper, or explaining in pictures in what he wants to communicate to me,
right.
And me to him, because what I say, he may not understand. So that kind of willingness and then wanting to communicate is, one step to
right.
get there.
Right, right. When you were reading the book, mm-hmm. as a Japanese person who's grown up here, what is one thing that kind of surprised you?
Yes, that there is one. Silence. What silence means in Japan. For example, this was actually something that I dealt with in a business meeting lately. You're in a meeting with Japanese people, and then you address some issue or ask a question, and then ask waiting for an answer, but you don't hear anything for a while. There's a long silence, and it may seem like they're indifferent or not interested in the matter, but that's hardly the case. And Ruth addresses this, and it's actually an act of self-control. And saving the emotions and saving the immediate reaction to the question. I thought that was really interesting because I'm not so quiet as you can hear.
Yeah, I was just thinking, Sachi, I really don't think that pertains to you very much. You're like the gaijin in the meeting. Hey guys, how's it going?
Let's go for a bike ride. So don't look at me as a stereotypical Japanese person because I'm not. And this is probably why I'm here on this show. But I thought that was really interesting because I've recently come across this. And I thought, oh, they're so quiet for such a long time. I want the answer. But they are thinking, and there's more of a careful thinking kind of process in the Japanese culture.
Right.
And it's not that they're indifferent. Or it's not that they're not interested, but it's more of a self-control. So if you think of the samurai kind of moment of being quiet and sitting still, but inside there's a lot going on.
Right.
So it's just a difference in culture, and then something of a culture shock it can be to some people outside.
You know, that's actually a very good exercise. I think anybody who wants to try to learn some self-control could practice is controlling your immediate response to anything.
Exactly.
And I learned this when we did the Bangkok podcast with the British monk that we interviewed for our Buddhism series. British monk. He's a British guy who's a monk in Thailand. His name is Prat Pandit. He's been in Thailand for a long time. And that particular show was about controlling your mind and your emotion. And he said one of the exercises you can do is whenever something happens to you, whether positive or negative, try to pause for a second before you react. You know, for example, if you're in traffic and someone cuts you off, your immediate natural reaction is to react, whether it's positive or negative, right? You just automatically react. And he suggested that try to pause for a second. And see if you can kind of control your reaction.
That's exactly what Ruth points out in this book too.
Really?
There's a section, she talks about there's no honking in Japan.
Right.
No one rarely honks in Japan.
Right.
So I've had some guests from abroad recently, and she said, she was from Taiwan, and she said, no one honks on the street. We were walking, and she said, it's so quiet here. And, I guess if you've been to Taiwan or say India or maybe Thailand too, honking all the time, really loud there. But here in Japan, you rarely hear honking.
I mean, Thailand actually is not so much just because there's gridlock traffic and no one's moving anyways. But you know, like, I remember when I was in Italy.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody was honking their horn. I didn't understand, are they honking at me or what? And then my Italian friend said, no, that's just how we drive. We drive one hand on the wheel and one hand on the horn.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's just they honk to honk, I think.
Right.
Here, honking can be really rude. And Ruth talks about this too. It might actually surprise people if you honk.
Right.
So just like you said about the British monk, pause and wait for a second. And then think about the person who's in front. Say there's a red light and then the car in front isn't moving. And it turns green and then the car in front isn't moving. But there might be some kind of a situation where that person is looking inside of a bag or something. So you wait for a little bit. And then that person keeps on moving, then that's fine. But if that person doesn't move for several seconds, then you might let them know, not by honking really loudly, but just go, boom.
Right.
You know, hello, how's it going there? And then that kind of honking you hear sometimes, but that's about it. And you rarely hear really loud honk here.
I think one thing that I've learned being an expat is patience. Because when you move to a new country and things that you could do so easily back home are suddenly massively complicated.
Do you have an example of that?
Oh, Christ. You have 4 hours of this show. I could go on and on, you know. I mean, even simple things like trying to open a bank account, trying to get a K-Tai, trying to pay your rent and all these kinds of things, right? In every country I lived in, everything is different. So, you have to learn how to be patient. Otherwise, you'll go nuts. True. And I think here in Japan, the Japanese people, that's part of their culture. It's just being patient.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that, you know, I learned as an expat, but I think that people could learn from Japan this extra layer of patience, this extra control over your immediate reaction.
It's so true. This must be the opposite of like Latin blood. Like you said, you know, opposite of Italian people or maybe like South American people.
So the big question is though, is after reading this book, are you going to put silence in your conversation?
Of course. Yes, it's important. And it shows a certain level of respect too. Sometimes, not all the time.
Right.
But, you know, there are moments when you should be silent.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, it can be taken as a lack of passion, I think.
Right, right.
And
yeah.
I think it can be taken it that way. But if you look at it from the positive side,
right,
it's a self-control and respect to the others.
Right.
Yeah, so Ruth made me learn about some of my culture that I didn't really, you know, think of. Until you point it out, you don't think about that in the daily life. So,
I asked Ruth if she's going to translate the book into English, and she said not immediately because the book was written for a Japanese audience, and she also said that parts of the book, parts of the story, some of the analogies won't translate well into English. The meaning gets lost.
Right.
Would you agree?
I do agree. This the things that she points out comes from a thorough understanding of the culture and then also from knowing the language.
Right.
One of the things that she says here is if you want to understand the culture, especially she says this to the expat people who can read Japanese, is that if you want to learn Japan, you have to learn the language. And this is not about Japan, but living anywhere, you know, if you want to understand the country, you have to know the language to fully really understand what's behind it.
Right.
So, learning the language and knowing the culture, and she knows that, and she writes that from knowing the language. So if she translates this directly to English, it won't work. So I think she would have to change the content to explain why the things are the way they are
to foreigners. Right.
Yeah. So that, yeah, direct translation wouldn't work.
Right. The context would get changed and she'd probably end up doing too much explanation.
Yeah,
and then the story would get a bit lost.
Exactly. And then everything written here is written in a positive way.
Right.
And then, of course, some of the things can be, for me, from living in the other side, some of the things can be taken as an annoying things or something that we can improve as Japanese people.
Can you give an example?
Like the silence or the self-control. Yes, of course it can be taken as a good thing, but not all the time.
Right.
And it doesn't work in the situation of like globalization because that's not the culture in the other side.
Right.
So, you know, we want them to understand our culture and then want them to understand what this silence means, or, you know, not saying yes. This is another thing that she says, but not saying yes immediately doesn't mean no here. But for them to understand this, it will take time, and then also knowing the language and the culture fully. So pointing this out, and they're saying this is the way it is in Japan, so please understand, won't work.
Right.
Of course, the willingness to know this from the readers is definitely necessary.
Was there any one of the points, any parts of the book that you disagreed with?
Yes, it's a good book. I think some things I think that can go in a deeper way. But at the same time, she wrote this in Japanese as a foreigner. So I think for that, I think it's good. I would have asked, I wanted to read more insights in some things. But she kind of glosses over 33 things. Each section is quite short.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I read it twice so I can talk to you.
Right.
And I saw the connections between some sections. So if she, but she doesn't really connect all those things at the end.
Right.
It's just like 1 through 33 and then it's over.
Right.
But I wish she connected all those things and summarized, then that would have been even better.
Okay, so it's quite a quick read then. It's just,
yes, this is a very, very quick read.
Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
And you felt that there wasn't a strong summary near the end.
Yeah, I wanted even more.
Well, you know what Ruth told me? She said that when she was asked to write this book, her publisher asked her, could you write a book like this? And her response was, how did Ruth put it? She said, if you gave me every single piece of paper in the world, I could still write more.
Right. So I know, you know, we know she wants to say more than this.
Right. So she needs the sequel, which is 66 reasons.
Yeah.
And then the three-peat, which would be 99 more reasons. And just keep going from there.
Yeah, the complete edition of Ruth's view.
But yeah, you're right though. You know, I really do feel that Ruth has a very good insight into Japan. She's been here a long time and she's worked in all levels of Japanese company from, you know, I remember when in her interview, she said that when her first job was answering the phone and she didn't even know how to write her name in katakana.
Right.
And I didn't even know how to do that either. and then all the way up to CEO of her own company. So I do feel that she has a lot of insight into Japanese culture and business culture that all the rest of us can benefit from.
Yeah. I mean, obviously from reading this book, you can feel that she loves Japan. Many, many things are written in a subjective view rather than the objective view of comparing different cultures. That's
right.
Because she loves Japan and she wants Japanese people to notice these things.
Right.
And with that message, I think it's written in a good way.
Mm.
But from my point of view, I wanted to see more of the objective view. But this can be a different book because this is not meant to be read like that.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Well, hopefully Ruth will do a sequel then.
Yes.
Hopefully she'll do a bilingual sequel so those of us whose Nihongo is not that great can read it.
Yeah, if she pointed out some things that we can improve upon, I think that would have been even better because this one says, this is good, you should be proud of it. And then I'm so, you know, flattered to be told like this. But at the same time, there are many things that we can improve, of course. So, listening
right,
to that actually, side would have been even nicer.
Right, that would be actually a very interesting book because I'm sure she sees lots of areas where Japan could improve.
Yes.
And so to hear her talk about that would be very interesting as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's great. Thanks, Ashley. Thanks for coming on the show and giving us a review of her book. If people want to find out more about Sachi-san and her epic bike journey, you can check out her website at findingsachi.com. And Ruth's book is available in amazon.jp, where all the reviews actually are quite positive. Seems like a lot of people are enjoying the book. So if you're thinking about coming to Japan or you want a good insight into Japanese culture, I highly recommend picking it up. Thanks, Hachi. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks again to Sachi for coming on the show. If you want to check out the interview I did with her earlier, look for Tokyo Podcast episode number 20, where we talked about her bike ride from Okinawa to Hokkaido. You can also visit her website at findingsachi.com. Ruth's book is available online through Amazon.jp or in hardcover at bookstores throughout Japan. Like Sachi just said, she highly recommends anyone who's interested in Japanese culture picking up a copy. If you have a review, a comment, or you'd like to be on the show, feel free to send me a message through Facebook at facebook.com/Tokyo Podcast. I can also be found on Twitter at Tokyo Podcast as well. And if you're listening to the show through iTunes on your iDevice, I'd appreciate a review or a comment on iTunes. If you have a moment, feel free to rate me on iTunes and leave a comment, as that helps boost my ranking up in the iTunes store. So if you can do that, I really appreciate it. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope to be back fully functioning with all my computers working next week. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.